Hi, everybody. Ooh, so loud. Hi. Hi, everybody. Okay, I'll use my normal voice so you can set the thing. I'm going to put my water there because I think I'll be instantly needing to drink all the water that exists in the world. Hi. And welcome. I'm Erica, the newest member of the teaching team, all green and whatnot. Thanks. Good news is here at Liminal, there is a teaching team, so there's six or seven of us who alternate weekly teaching. So if you're new, thanks for being here today, and if you don't like what I have to say, you can come back next week, and it'll be somebody else. This is my first time up here, so, you know, let's see how it goes. All right, a little bit about me, since it's the first time, just so we can get to know each other. I was raised in the Lutheran church by a Catholic mom and a non-denominational dad who says that when he asked, like, five-year-old me where I wanted to go to school, it's time to go to school, that I said to him, quote, that I wanted to go where I can learn about Jesus Christ as my Savior. I guess he took that literally because the school I ended up at name was called Our Savior Lutheran. And the Lutherans are pretty literal, too. So imagine my surprise when in the eighth grade we migrated from the NIV version of the Bible to, from the King James version to the NIV version. And they're like, this is the same book. And I was like, no, one of these things is not like the other. These are entirely different. So that was an enlightening moment, and since then I've read seven different translations of the Bible from soup to nuts to cope with that fact that, in fact, we have translations, and I was not literally getting the Word of God to, like, King James or something. I don't know. I was a little kid. I thought that's how it was. So side note, and this talk might be nothing but a whole series of side notes strung together, I took 2 years of Hebrew in college because I had that idea as a kid that maybe if I learned Hebrew, then I could learn Aramaic, and then maybe I could actually, like, read what I thought God wrote someday. And no, I did not get that far, even by a long shot. But I've also read a good fistful of works from, like, John Maxwell and Richard Rohr and Joyce Meyer, John Bevere. So that's the vibe of kind of background and influence that I have. So. Also, I've got a degree in directing, theater, not film, and it's in the process of collaborative creation that I experience God most profoundly, where two or three are gathered and like that. So my family has a background in medicine, and I dabbled in the medical field for like 10 years while getting through college and stuff, and now I work in digital identity for a small consulting firm, and I'm also licensed in financial services, insurance, and securities, so spirit of full disclosure there. I am not here to teach about any of that, but I do teach people how to grow wealth and get financially independent, and yes, that's really a thing. Yes, it is also possible, and no, it's not that hard, but it requires discipline, patience, and a little bit of faith, not unlike a walk with the Almighty. Okay, so Wayne had a couple of disclaimers last week. I have a couple too. One, there's one adult theme in my talk today, so be advised. Secondly, I've been fasting since the first, so if I talk crazy, we're going to blame it on that. All right. Also, another side, I went from a side note now to another side note. See how I roll. It's fun in my head. Fun fact about me, I have what I call, like, the switcheroos, and that's like a dysgraphia dyslexia combination that really makes for fun times. So sometimes I even conflate concepts if they're nearby each other, like right and left. And if two things are similar, I'm in trouble. But that just kind of gives me to what we're talking about today, which is transitions and transformations. So slide, please. This is the last teaching in our Stories of Liminality series, and when I think of these kinds of stories, these two words are what comes to mind. And for our purposes, I wrote my notes this morning, you guys, so for the purposes of this morning, I'm going to flow between these two words and concepts and even use them interchangeably, but they do have a slight nuance between them, right? A transition is a passing or passage from one condition, action, or rarely a place, to another change, like just something moving to somewhere else, where transformation is an act, process, or instance of undergoing a profound, radical, or complete change in form, appearance, nature, or character. So one of them is kind of an external thing, like somebody that moves from one place to another might be transitioning from one place to another, but transformation is like an internal job. We're going to pretend that's kind of all the same for our purposes this morning. So I want to start here at Romans 12:2, which says, "And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." So this is a scripture that I have now plucked out of context, but hang in there with me. In context, it's amazing. Go read Romans if you haven't to get that whole thing. But for today, we're just going to look at this at face value, and it tells us a couple of important things. One, transformation is a thing. We change. We're wired for change. Two, how do we do that? By the renewing of your mind. So change your thoughts, change your life, which also includes defend your thinking space. Esther does this, and it might well be the key to her impact. So it's Esther we're talking about today, too, guys. So I'm going to talk about a few threads of transition and transformation, and then we'll take a look at Esther. So everybody read Esther's like advanced reading, right? Because you saw the thing and the place? No? Okay. You're in luck, though, because I'm going to talk about transitions and transformations for a little while. So if you have, you know, your phone with you, you can Bible Gateway it up. It's pretty short. It's only like 10, so if you want to do double things. No? Okay. You guys with me? You're all very like, we're in church, it's quiet. I forgot to say the thing where you, yeah, thanks. Just give, like, just holler at some point. You could just, in the middle. Okay. All right, a few things about transformation. I'm going to posit some things. You can think about them. It's all there is. Since we live inside of a physical reality bounded by time, time moves. So by definition, things don't stay the same. Even when we're still and when we're waiting, time is happening. So we are ourselves made up of organic physical stuff, and it moves, we move, we're in movement. In fact, a good amount of change happens in the moving, and opportunity lies in the movement to do or be something new, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So the slide for anybody who's a Sandman fan is just a little bit from the graphic novel where Dream and Delirium are talking, and she said, what's the name of that word for things not being the same always? You know, I'm sure there is one, isn't there? There must be a word for it. The thing that lets you know that time is happening, is there a word? And he says, change. All right, next thing. There are multiple simultaneous changings. Tiny cycles inside of larger cycles. We have physical birth and death marking one like overarching cycle of our experience while we're here. Age marked by years inside of that, another cycle. Seasons are versions of that. So cats, they say, have 9 lives. How many have you had? I was looking at my CV above where I was just telling you a little about my background. I thought like, oh, I've had quite a few lives. I've had, my life as a child. Call those the indoctrination years. Early adult life, theater life, medical life, financial advisor life, mom life, community member life. Each of these new lives came from thinking new thoughts, right? New seasons of life. I had new things I was learning or developing or growing around, and then voila, a new life. And all of those are tucked into my one big, long journey of this physical experience. So our lives are like many chapters in a book. What's great about life and transformation is we can shift our life at any time to a different life, much like turning the page. Sometimes we find it happens by external motivations. Oh, fired from my job. Guess what? I guess I'll have a new life doing something new. Sometimes it's internal motivations. We read a book or have an impactful event or evening or song or something that changes things for us. But what we do have absolute control over in a very uncertain world is two things, our attitude and our activity. So for me, this is an amazing aspect of our journey being created in the image of God, the creator, because if you're not happy with your life, change. Start over. God did more than once. It's part of the value of time. Things keep moving, so if you're not happy, keep moving. And if you are happy, keep moving and improving and expanding. Expanding is also a godlike expression, or at least very much like the universe they created. Trinity, they. Sorry, not sorry. All right, so if transition and transformation have all this God epistemology, ooh, easier to write, not as easy to speak, this connection to the very nature of God, then why do we have so much fear associated with transition and transformation, right? The joke here is like, who wants change? Everybody, who wants to change? Crickets. So let's twist the diamond. There's a great book called A Brief History of Intelligence by Max Bennett. And in this book, he bridges the gap between neuroscience and this book's talking about AI to tell the brain's evolutionary story. That's the main thing here. And it reveals how understanding how brains evolved can help shape the next generation of AI breakthroughs, hopefully, and help us not from all killing ourselves with AI and stuff. What's interesting here is the deep dive he takes into the brain development stuff. So stay with me. There's a chapter on the origin of emotion where fear is one stimuli output linked to the exploration around survival. So he goes all the way back to like nematodes and stuff before there was brain, just how movement happened and so on and so forth. So there was a time in development before emotion showed up when there would be either movement towards stimuli because of a benefit like food or away from a stimuli because of a detriment or harm like death. So as soon as emotions got involved, fear was the emotion that served as a flag for the unknown. There's a stimulus, unknown stimulus, take caution. Sometimes we don't appreciate fear, we just want to get rid of it. And there's a lens through which fear is something to be excited about because it's a signal that the unknown has an opportunity to be known, right? We can note that the signal is an opportunity to know something new and therefore be transformed by the renewing of our mind, by the new knowing of the new thing in our minds, the new data, new input, right? You've probably all heard the phrase, if you know better, do better. That's this idea. In the experiencing of a thing, we get the results of the signal. Like we know in an experiential way, not just an idea way, what it is. Should we really be scared? Is it good? Is it bad? That sort of thing. And our response to learning what it is shaped by those two things we can control, our attitude and our activity. This is why there's different outcomes for people faced with the same challenges or experiences. Our reactions and thoughts and feelings about a thing matter. This is important for when we look at the differences between Queen Vashti and Queen Esther. So we make phrases like expect the worst, hope for the best to try and cope with this concept, but it's rare that someone actually has a positive expectation and anticipation of the unknown. So I invite us to practice that. Sometimes we're just too attached to what's known. Also known as just being too comfortable, because we know it, and that feels good. And we don't like things that we don't like to have happen. But the truth is, in the unknown, there's any number of outcomes, right? The judging of it is what breeds fear. So, you know, what if we simply allow the input of the new experience without judgment? So I'll posit that if we're living like God created us as part of an ever-unfolding and growing and expanding universe, as ever-unfolding and growing and expanding humans, in an ever-unfolding and growing and expanding experience of God and relationship with them, then maybe we acknowledge the fear and run straight at the unknown, like Esther did. All right, Proverbs now. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he shall direct your path. Simply put, trust, as my kids say. Esther would have studied Proverbs, and now let us take a look at what we know about her. So, here's a quick synopsis. But first, like many of the Old Testament stories, I've had a lot of issues with Esther over the years. because as we do when we're audience members, I regularly engaged with her story from a if it was me perspective, right? And for this assignment, I decided to be curious because all the times I've heard her story, I've been like, well, if it was me, I would have done such and such. And if it was me, I would have, maybe. All right, so here's the brief synopsis. Here's how I understood it when I was young. Queen Vashti was queen of the Persian Empire. She was sassy and rebellious. The king exiled her for it. He then held a beauty contest for a new queen. Mordecai, Esther's guardian, gets Esther in the contest. She's beautiful, so is appointed the queen. Then she uses her beauty as a weapon to manipulate the king. Her people are saved. That's the good news. The bad guy gets hanged. Mordecai gets honored. The Jewish nation is saved. Moral of the story, be like Esther. And I was like, oh, I can't. That can't be good. Like, the moral of the story can't just like be like, oh, yeah, use your beauty to manipulate in the world. Go, women. Like, no, we don't want to do that. So, curiosity then. We're in the Persian Empire under the rule of Persian Emperor Xerxes I. We're in the capital city of Susa, which is 850 miles-ish due east of Jerusalem. So the distance from L.A. to Portland, call it. This is about 100 years after the temple was burned to the ground, which started the Jewish nation's exile in Babylon. And Jews are now scattered all over, and some have begun to reassemble in Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. But we're here in Persia, in a society where power was strictly hierarchical and patriarchal. Women were often treated as political or sexual commodities, as evidenced by the mass gathering of virgins for the king's pleasure and the immediate exile of a queen who challenged male authority. The Persian king, Xerxes I, is called in our reading Ahasuerus, who throws this ridiculous, and then I put the strike through in my notes, who throws a lavish 180-day military summit and subsequent 7-day drunken banquet in the capital of Susa, during which time he summons Queen Vashti to display her beauty wearing her royal crown. Now, there's some controversy here about if the king summoned her to come wearing only her crown, but either way, she's not having it, and she refuses. And her shocking refusal causes a political panic and prompts the king and his advisors to legally banish her and attempt to ensure her insubordination does not spread to other women. And they issue an empire-wide decree forcing all women to honor their husbands. So the Book of Esther presents a fascinating character study of these two women who navigate the absolute patriarchal authority of King Assyrus's court in completely opposite ways. Where Vashti chooses direct confrontation and defiance, Esther employs strategic subversion. All right, so when does Esther's transformation happen? Over time and in the movement of it, right? In storytelling, transformation is usually an intellectual like discovery or recognition. Like, there's usually an exact moment that a hero makes the critical realization and shifts gears and changes the world and stuff. It's not clear that Esther has a single moment like this, but we can imagine and do see there are a lot of moments over the time in her story. And while we don't get a lot of info on her temperament at the beginning of the story, we do see who she is at the end. We also know that the Book of Esther has one of the most famous Bible quotes, at least of the Old Testament, in which Mordecai says to her, "Hey, you might die, but who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Which highlights the notion that everything that has happened for this moment right now in her life. And that comment of Mordecai's is a literary pivotal moment, a plot pivot. But Esther's personal changes were more spread out over time. Sorry, something jumped in my head that I needed to tell you, and now I forgot what it is. Okay, we'll come back to it. All right, so a lot can happen in 3 slides. Let's zip through these. What do we have here? Chapter 2. All right. Each young woman's turn came to go into King Assyrus after she had completed 12 months of preparation according to the regulations for the women. And these were the days of their preparation portions. 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. So they smelled really, really good. Thus prepared, each young woman went into the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go to the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. Now, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. Haggai was the custodian of the women from the first house, and then they go to the king, and then they go to the second house, right? Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. So in contrast to my first summary earlier, how Esther becoming queen more likely went down is that, first of all, the king decreed that all the young virgins in his kingdom be sent to him, period. In those days, the king did what he wanted with whomever he wanted. There were many virgins available, and unless one of them pleased him, he would have one night with them, and then they became a concubine, and he would never see them again, and they would go live with his other possessions. Fun times. That was their life. Raped by the king, and you get to live. Probably. And in 2026, we may know that relationship is not ownership, but in Esther's time, if you were a woman, you were owned, or maybe a beggar on the street. So, let's back up a little bit. Young Esther is an orphan being raised by her older cousin, Mordecai. I really like that name. So if you know this cartoon, this character's name, Mordecai, is one of my favorites. And I immediately always thought of Esther's uncle. I don't know why, because I was raised in a Lutheran school. And so that's just like, so we could have a breath with Mordecai. All right, sorry. So Esther gets collected into the virgins for the king, and Mordecai tells her to keep her true identity a terrifying secret, since she was Jewish, because trouble, right? So Esther pleases the king and then gets crowned the queen of Persia. So this part would all be flowers and rainbows, yay for Esther, except there's another character in the story, the villainous Haman, who's like the hand of the king for Game of Thrones people. Here's the thing I was going to tell you earlier. Esther's unique in the Old Testament in so much as that God's really not in it. God's not really mentioned. There's no angel shows up. It's just like Esther and Mordecai trying to figure it out. And so what's kind of interesting about that to me is watching Esther's transformation. And also, I haven't had any angels show up to give me messages, so I can relate to the fact of like, oh, we have our scriptures and the stuff we studied, and then we're trying to figure it out. So, okay. That was an unscripted side note. All right, let's get back here. So the conflict that arises with Haman, the hand of the king guy, is that Mordecai, Esther's uncle, uncovers a plot to assassinate the king. And so he tells the king, and then he's like, right on, bro, you're down, you're in and stuff. But Mordecai, who was looked nicely upon by the king, didn't bow down to Haman, the hand of the king. And so Haman didn't like that because big ego. So he manipulates the king into signing a decree to annihilate all the Jews in the empire on a specific date. He's like, oh yeah, that one guy won't bow down to me. Everybody's done. Okay. Overreact much? Esther ends up putting her life on the line because Mordecai lives his principles. He wasn't going to bow down to this other guy. And Haman has this huge ego. So Mordecai learns about this edict to kill all the Jewish nation, and his bright idea is to have Esther then put her life on the line to talk to the king and persuade him to save their people. what could go wrong? So a couple paragraphs about that here. Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king," which is against the law, "and if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. So this is all interesting for a few reasons, but you know, Mordecai's like, look, you haven't told him who you are, but he's going to find out and he's going to kill you along with everybody else. So why not go for it? And she's like, okay, I'm going to need some time. Give me 3 days of fasting and everybody fast with me. We see what we can do. Again, like no angel, no God plan, no clues or anything. She's just figuring it out. And she spends 3 days fasting. And my first thought here was like, and praying. But it doesn't say praying. I assume she's praying Proverbs 3:5-6, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him and she shall direct your paths. But it doesn't say praying. Maybe she did, maybe she didn't. But what we do know is that she had confidence, just like Mordecai, because what he said to her was, if you don't do it, deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. He was so confident that they were going to be saved that he was like, hey, you might do it, but if you don't do it, somebody else is going to do it. And we see echoes of that, by the way, in the New Testament. I think it's Paul who's like, look, do the thing. God has the entire world full of people. If you're called to do a thing and you don't do a thing, he'll find somebody else to do it. But you get to have an opportunity, if you're called to do something, to do it. So I think Esther was kind of in this kind of place. Does that make sense? You guys with me? Okay. All right. Right. So maybe she believed that she was beloved of the Almighty and things would unfold exactly as the Almighty desired. Right. What if we remember who we are like that? So she walks into court, finds favor in the king's eyes. Right. Because nobody was allowed to just walk on in. But if anybody did, the king could like extend his staff. And then if he did that, then they wouldn't be immediately killed. So she walks in. He extends the staff. She's not immediately killed. And she strategically baits Haman by inviting the king and Haman to a series of exclusive wine banquets. And during the first one, she doesn't really say much. And the second one, the tension is really suffocating, but she finally gathers some courage and drops the bombshell of her own Jewish heritage and exposes Haman's plot to kill the Jewish nation right to the king's face. So he gets really angry, he erupts in fury, and orders Haman to be executed on his own gallows. So, yay, that was a win for a win for everybody, but the decree that he put in place to kill everybody was still there, so I had to deal with that. And they couldn't change what was already decreed, but they did add an asterisk that said it's lawful for the Jewish nation to defend itself. So also upshot for the Jewish nation, because like the day arrived, like there's a thing, I don't remember what the, like there's a social thing about that, right? Like, oh, it's free kill anybody you want day. You guys know about that? Like I've got kids, they're teenagers. Okay. And so it was like that kind of a day, except it was only for the Jews. Like if you lived there and so you could kill any Jews that day. But they added this asterisk so the Jews could fight back, and now it's a fair fight. And so, you know, it doesn't say that anybody was killed. So I don't have those numbers, but I don't think anybody was. Okay. All right. Let's move on from that. A little bit happily ever after at the end. And from that happy ending, we can identify a few aspects of Esther's transformation and transition and a couple other takeaways. So first of all, Esther learned from Vashti. Vashti before her was defiant, and her strategy was to assert her personal boundaries and, you know, directly challenge the king's public authority. She refused to participate in her own objectification, and
prioritized her dignity over her obedience, but, side note, in her defense, Jewish historian Josephus noted in the first century that the king's command actually violated Persian custom. It was considered highly improper for a queen to be paraded in front of a massive crowd of outside drunken men. But nonetheless, the consequence of her choice to stand up for herself was that she caused a localized panic, and then she had to be like kicked out of the system and lost all of her power and all of her platform. So we can see how witnessing that would show Esther what not to do. All right, so Esther, on the other hand, matures from a compliant member of the harem, really, into a sophisticated political strategist. She initially relies on the guidance of Mordecai and Haggai the eunuch from the first house, where she was beautified, and then eventually she assumes leadership. She commands her own fasts, and she directs the royal court's attention through her carefully curated influence. She can't rely on a sword, but as a woman, she can rely on her wits, perfect timing, and flawless strategic hosting skills to outmaneuver the situation. Esther weaponizes the very traits the patriarchy demands of her: beauty, submissiveness, and patience. She undergoes the required beauty treatments without complaint. She hides her Jewish identity as instructed and relies on the king's eunuch for advice on what to do. She makes herself the exact image of the ideal compliant Persian woman to everybody's benefit. So she did not attempt to overthrow the patriarchal structure. She recognized that she was ensconced in it. And unlike Vashti, she achieved her objectives by operating within its rules, using the very tools of the system to get what she wanted to get out of it. So she understood that in a society where favor was the primary currency, she couldn't demand anything, much less change. But by going with the flow and conforming to the expectations of her, she built the social capital necessary to be heard. And then being heard, she made her impact. She waited for the right time and utilized a slow, indirect approach, and that allowed the king to feel as though he was in control of the situation, because, in fact, he was, after all. So, was she manipulative then, or was she leveraging her position as the queen? All right, so in the end, maybe the moral of the story is still to be like Esther, but what has shifted for me is what that actually means. All right, I'll leave us with a couple of invitations here at the end. The first is this: instead of being scared of transitions and transformations and change, allow ourselves a new life. Embrace the cycles and be curious about what's next. Second, practice the renewing of our minds by trusting the Almighty and reconsidering fear when it comes up. Maybe it's an opportunity. In a life of constant change, trust God. Third, in embracing each new life in our life, let your light so shine before humans that they may see your good works and glorify the Almighty in heaven. That's a little bit about what we're made for. And then fourthly, practice allowing experiences to open our minds to what the Almighty is up to. Look for and expect God's goodness towards us. We can condition our thoughts and therefore our emotions to allow God's graciousness in our lives. We made it to the end. Thank you. And for any Lutherans in the house, I'll leave you with this. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Amen.